We'll take questions from the audience. Dr. Fontaine.
Yes, you had mentioned in your talk that the level of VEGF changed the response rates of bevacizumab. So I was wondering if you have high levels of VEGF concentration,
does the presence of a high level of VEGF concentration maybe mandate a higher use or a dose escalation, or are you limited by side effects and toxicity?
I think that's an open question. Bevacizumab has been used at a range of different doses in different cancers, and it's really unclear what the optimal dose is in most of those cancers, including mesothelioma, for which we use 15 milligrams per kilogram every 3 weeks. There are some other diseases in which we use 5 milligrams per kilogram every 2 weeks. So the answer is unknown, but possibly.
I notice in your slides that you have the BAP1, some places it's in italics, and some places it's in regular font. My understanding is the gene is the same name, but the gene is represented in the italics, and the protein is represented in normal font. Is there any difference in the mutation between the two?
Yeah, normally, I mean, again, in the scientific field, we talk about the gene, we use italic, and if we talk about the protein, it's all capital. You just distinguish between the gene and the gene and the protein. But the protein is translated from the gene.
Yes, so it, is it the protein we're talking about here, or the gene itself?
So the gene mutation caused the change of the protein. Basically, the gene mutation caused the damage of the protein function. So basically, the function of the protein will be the consequence of the gene mutation.
Okay. Then, backing up a bit, if you have a mutant gene, the BAP1 gene, is it you're more susceptible to mesothelioma, or does it enable, does it cause, is asbestos more effective or hit you sooner?
So based on our study, especially using BAP1 plus minus mouse model, we found, as I showed, the BAP1 mutation can predispose the individual to even very, very low dose of asbestos. So basically, we use 10 times less asbestos, which doesn't really cause much mesothelioma in Y-type mice. We saw high incidence already in the plus-minus mice.
So it's the exposure then to the asbestos. I mean, you're not going to have a situation where you have a mutant gene, and that causes the cancer without exposure of any kind to asbestos?
So that is, in fact, a sensitive and very difficult question to answer, because our study, we only use asbestos exposure, just a different dose. But I do see some other group, for example, Dr. Testa's group, he used his mouse model, and he did see some sporadic, spontaneous mesothelioma, although the number is very low. So at this moment, I think it's hard to draw any conclusion. So basically, okay. I think your question is, without asbestos exposure, BAP1 mutant individual whether can develop mesothelioma or not, right? So I think the question is still there. We are not sure yet.
Okay, because it's this distinction is being used in court today as to saying, okay, we didn't cause your mesothelioma because you had a BAP1 gene that was mutant. And that's why I'm trying to clarify that. The other thing past this is a mutant BAP1 gene is also associated with squamous cancer as well. And the thing about that, that's almost a heads up, because of squamous cancer, you get to see a lot earlier in life because it's on your skin. It shows up. You don't see the mesothelioma until it's basically too late. And is there any association between the two? I mean, if you get a heads up on the if you went in with squamous or skin cancer, would it be worthwhile doing a test to see if you had a BAP1 mutancy that would allow you to say, I need to look forward in life because now I could be also susceptible to further cancer?
So to answer your first question, again, as I said, it's not conclusive. So I know this thing involves a lot of litigation, so I don't want to comment too much. I just show basically what we found in our lab, that we use high or low dose of asbestos, and definitely you see the difference of BAP1 mutant carrier, those mice. So then basically our finding is those mutation can sensitize those people to even low dose of asbestos. The next question you had is about screamers. In those cohorts, those population we are studying, we do see some squamous cancer development. However, the number is very small still. So we are waiting for larger cohort study, also from other group and researchers try to find the p-value to see there is a significant link. However, in my slides also show there is a skin lesion we call M-base. It's not a malignant tumor. However, we saw a lot in the in the BAP1 mutant carriers. And especially those skin lesions started develop in very young age. In fact, we saw one young kid, 12 years, we also already found those lesions. Those lesions are not malignant, so you can easily remove. But that could be an indicator, as you suggested, to link to BAP1 mutation. However, it's very challenging also to diagnose. We need also more pathologists to help us involve this study.
Okay, we'll move on to the...
Yeah, that's probably relating to this question. So not all mesothelioma patient has, you know, BAP1 mutant. So, and then this signaling, BAP1 probably relating to calcium signaling as well. So that means is maybe this BAP1 is some kind of tumor suppressor gene. Then how about BAP1 mutant in other cancer? Is there any cancer got the same thing?
So there are two things I want to talk. One is the germline mutation that basically I talked a lot. There is also somatic mutation. Basically, you found in germline is wild type, but in the tumor, BAP1 is mutant. That has been studied a lot, including mesothelioma and other cancer as well. So yes, BAP1 is a tumor suppressor. And once it's mutant, it predisposes to carcinogen, including mesothelioma, uveal melanoma, cutaneous melanoma, and also clear cell renal cancer was also published and connected to BAP1 mutation. And whether there are additional cancer, we don't know yet. There are some studies kind of reporting cases of different cancer carrying BAP1 mutation. And in fact, in those families we have been following, we do see quite a large range of cancer types besides what I just mentioned. So again, we are waiting for more people getting involved and helping us to understand, especially more researchers and clinicians to find the link. And the second question, basically the second issue is the somatic BAP1 mutation. The somatic BAP1 mutation, although it's only happened in the tumor, but the loss of BAP1 function in those tumor also plays a critical role of the prognosis and response to chemo. However, if you look at different cancer type, there seems reported differently regarding the prognosis and survival. For uveal melanoma, it's reported that BRCA mutation, you see more in metastatic disease and seems the prognosis is poor. However, in mesothelioma seems opposite. However, the number is still small. So I think there will need also be further study to draw a clear conclusion.
So I just had a couple of quick questions. Is there any difference between the mutational burden in the BAP1 mutant versus wild type tumors? I haven't seen that published, but you would think that if there really is an impact on DNA damage repair from BAP1, that you might expect to see an increased mutational burden in the BAP1 patients. Has that been looked at yet? And I haven't seen it in the literature.
That is what we have developed some preliminary, but we are still working on that. So I don't want, since it's still preliminary stage, I don't want to kind of draw some conclusion, but we have been looking at it.
And the second question, it has to do with the Warburg effect. That was very interesting data that was published recently. It sort of raises the question, is asbestos also inducing a Warburg effect, or is it potentiating the Warburg phenomenon in these BAP1 mutant cells versus wild type?
That's another great question. In fact, that is also the project we have been working on. Asbestos, possible. The thing is, asbestos also causes cell death. So it makes the study kind of challenging because you have the combination of metabolomic profile change, and in the meantime, there are the cell death. However, if I can cite some other group study, not on mesothelioma, but in other cancer, they do see, for example, appear at Vanderbilt. He published a study using smoking cohorts, and he found that cigarette smoking can induce Warburg effect in lung epithelial cells. So that kind of suggests probably we might see the same thing in asbestos caused mesothelioma.
And Dr. Nowak and Dr. Olevsky, there's obviously different ways to attack mesothelioma now with anti-angiogenic therapy, checkpoint blockade, and chemotherapy, standard chemotherapy. And there's different ways to go about combining all these things. And do you guys see there's any unifying way to do this in a kind of organized way that people are going to all buy into, or is it going to be kind of haphazard?
That's a great question, and unfortunately, a lot of what we do is actually driven by who owns the drug that we're trying to use. So I think it behoves us to look in the laboratory and see if we can make rational preclinical combinations and then take those data and see if we can make links between companies that own different drugs, because unfortunately when you look at the clinical trials that are around where they're combining two immunotherapy drugs, they're mostly combining two drugs that are made by the same company. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's necessarily the right way to go about it from a scientific point of view. It's very difficult.
This question, sorry.
For I have a few head that you dated in and said, is good, interesting to understand how is the potential better strategies for all patients with cancer. I mean, a sequential treatment. Immunotherapy then chemotherapy, because we, for example, have seen a proportion of patients who receive the chemotherapy after immune checkpoint inhibitors have a better response. But also chemotherapy can create a more favorable environment to immunotherapy. But this aspect have to be better understood within the clinical trials.
I think this question overlaps what he just said. Can these different therapies, like he was saying, the one about the freezing therapy and the chemotherapy and the immunization one, can all of these be worked kind of simultaneously, or would you have to work each one hopefully separately, or because most people, once they're diagnosed, they don't have oodles of time, so you can't kind of keep putting them off. But could they ever be worked together, or like you said, doctor, that it depends on who owns what? And they want the credit to go to them, not to somebody else.
I think we're in a better position when we're looking at other therapies, such as cryotherapy or radiotherapy, which are more available and not dependent upon having somebody provide a drug. The difficulty with provision of drugs is that many of these new drugs cost many thousands of dollars, and then they have to be given every 2 to 3 weeks. So universities and the competitive funding systems can't actually afford to buy those drugs. You need to have the cooperation of the company that provides them. But the answer to your question is yes, absolutely, we can combine immunotherapies and cryotherapy, immunotherapy and radiotherapy. Once treatments become accepted and proven, we can then continue to add on stepwise. I suspect the future is going to be more multi-targeted, because there is redundancy in cancer, and every time you block one pathway, another one pops up. So we are going to need to use multiple modalities.
I have a question for Dr. Calvaro. How much toxicity do you see with combining the CTLA-4 blockade and the PD-L1 blockade? And have you ever used those two together? I saw that in the trials that were used sequentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Toxicities of a combination of immune checkpoint inhibitors are, of course, higher than those observed in monotherapy. In our study, we in particular found patients with gastrointestinal, severe gastrointestinal side effect. One patient had a neurological side effect, encephalitis, limbic encephalitis. But it's important to identify this side effect for a prompt treatment. Only 3 patients in our study required early discontinuation from this study because this was required from the clinical studies, but all patients resolved their side effect.
I've got a question for Dr. Yang. This may be a naive question, but is there any sort of physiological phenotype for your BAP1 germline mutation patients? For example, exercise capacity, obesity, anything else that would indicate or result from their altered metabolic profile that appears to be systemic?
So far, we haven't found any obvious physical change. So that needs to be further studied. In fact, we are hoping to do a more controlled study to study some specific metabolites to see whether under the same diet, strictly same condition or exercise, whether we see difference of the lactate level in those people's blood.
And I have a follow-up question for Dr. Yang. Clinically, do you see a difference in terms of response to chemotherapy, to the BAP1 mutant patients?
So what we found that we published two years ago, we found that people carrying germline BAP1 mutation have longer survival compared to Sears data. And we found the difference can be 7 times difference. Somatic is it's not from our group. We found a kind of margin difference, but other group report they also see difference, but it's not that dramatic as the germline BAP1 mutation. And regarding the response to certain type of therapy, I think still remains to be studied.
Also, is there a predominance of epithelioid in the BAP1 mutated?
That's true. That is true. Basically, with majority, I will say, not just from our group, also other group published the case with the germline BAP1 mutation, majority is epithelial type.
Okay. Do we have any other questions?
Okay, in that case, we can break for lunch, and the lunch is down.